Tigered. Welcome to the Talking Tigered podcast. My name is Kent Wyatt, the city's communications manager and host of the Talking Tigered podcast. I'm excited today to welcome our guest, Cynthia Gomez, to the podcast. Cynthia is the Director of Community and Civic Impact at Portland State University. If you're a longtime listener to the podcast, long as we've been around 2 years, so if you've been with us for that, you may remember about a year ago, we had another guest from Portland State University, Dr. Amy Lambert, who's the Vice President for Global Diversity and Inclusion at PSU. And so she shared at that point how PSU is working to ensure equity is embedded into all university operations. We'll touch a little bit on that today with Cynthia. I guess we should take a step back for our listeners. How did we get here? Well, one of my colleagues, Eduardo Ramos, recommended Cynthia as somebody who would be a great guest on the show, not to put a lot of pressure on her. And we also are in the middle of Hispanic Heritage Month, so we wanted to touch a little bit on that too. But overall, for today's episode, we'll talk to Cynthia about her work with the Latino community, how local government can do a better job in engaging all parts of the community, and then to that piece about how PSU is creating a more equitable community. So that's a long-winded way of saying welcome to the podcast, Cynthia.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, so let's do just a couple quick intro questions, get loose and ready for the bigger ones. So I'll throw a couple at you. What's your favorite thing about autumn or fall?
Well, I'm from the desert, so I absolutely love the change in weather. I love how blustery it gets and the leaves. It's lovely. It's great.
All right. We've been in COVID for 18 months and continuing on now. Thinking about this time period, what's the best purchase that you've made during COVID?
That's a good question. I would say, lots of comfy jammies and slippers.
Yeah, I've been like the casual athletic pant guy. That's been my purchases recently. So what's give us a hot take here. What's one thing, and maybe a TV show, movie, food, take it in any direction you want, that in your opinion is overrated?
Yeah. Well, that's it's kind of hard for me, but right now the first thing that's coming to mind is football. I'm not a huge fan of the football, but I think sports in general, I'm a baseball girl because that's what I grew up with. So I might be partial.
Do you have a favorite team?
I grew up in a place where the San Diego Padres had their spring training. So, I really enjoyed that team and had a good time watching them growing up.
Oh, that's cool. And then the last quick one here, we asked all of our guests is, besides Portland, what's your favorite city in the Portland area?
Oh, well.
We assume that it's Tigered, right?
It's got to be Tigered. I mean, for sure. I love your downtown. I think it's really sweet. My best friend used to work in the area. I can't remember the name. It was an Italian restaurant. And I used to go there and hang out with her, and then we'd go around downtown after work, after she got off work. So I enjoy Tigered. It's a sweet little place in the metro area.
That was a little bit of a trick question, but you handled it nicely. And we agree with the answer. As listeners, I can feel them nodding their heads in agreement. So off to a good start. Let's hop more into your background and then the work that you're doing. So you mentioned a little bit about growing up in Arizona. You moved to Oregon in 1993. Thinking back to then, what brought you to the area? And then since you've been here, what's been your career path?
I was born in Camp 52, which is a migrant camp outside of Phoenix. I grew up in Yuma, Arizona, which is on the border of U.S.-Mexico border as well as California. Lots of desert up until when I was 18. And then I moved to Flagstaff, Arizona. Beautiful, beautiful city. You get all four seasons there. It was the first time I'd really experienced an autumn, and seeing the leaves change. And for me, it had always been a dream of mine to move to a city. I'd always lived in small towns. And I couldn't think of a better place than Portland. I wanted to live on the West Coast. I wanted to live in a city, but not a big city. I still wanted that small town feel. And, you know, I made a lot of assumptions about Portland. I never visited before I moved here. But the second I got here, I knew that I'd be here for a while. And so far I've stayed. You know, I was very taken by the rivers and the bridges and nature, and really loved being able to go for hikes and enjoy the water. The water for me is everything here. Water is life. You know, I can plant things in my garden and they grow. It's kind of miraculous. I love it here. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And, you know, for my career, when I first moved here, when I lived in Flagstaff, I studied at Northern Arizona University and it didn't go so well. So I took a nice long break, you know, worked a lot all over the place, mostly in food service, but I also worked with developmentally disabled adults in Flagstaff for this organization called Hojoni Foundation. So when I moved here, I mostly did food service, but I did spend 5 years at McMenamins. I worked at the Baghdad Theater. And then I decided that I wanted to go back to school and finish my degree. So I went to PSU and found out that I didn't have very long to go. So I got my bachelor's pretty quickly and then decided I wanted to just keep going. I enrolled in graduate school. And while I was doing that, I found my love of teaching and working in the Latino community. I ran a program for an organization called the Oregon Council for Hispanic Advancement, which is no longer around, but they had a leadership academy called the Oregon Leadership Institute, where we worked with Latino high school youth in the area, and we pulled them in and would bring them to PSU one Saturday a month, and we would do leadership academies, and the students would work with them and mentor these youth. It was just a formidable time in my career when I realized that I had not only an interest, but a skill that could be of service to my community. So I started doing that. And then I got pulled into Latino Network, which you may know is one of the larger Latino serving organizations in the area. And I got pulled in to serve on their board of directors. This was, you know, many, many years ago, like in 2002. And during my time on the board, we started a consortium of service providers with the Department of Community Justice to serve justice impacted youth. And I loved it so much, I left the board so I can become a provider. And then I just stayed at Latino Network for about 10 years. Ended up when I left, I did leadership development mostly. So I became the director of civic engagement and leadership programs. And when I saw that there was a role that opened up at Portland State that felt like it was a good fit for me. And it was being the executive director of the cultural resource centers, overseeing the cultural centers, I thought I'd go for it. And then I got the job. During that whole time, I'd been teaching at PSU as an adjunct, and I continue to teach today. It's something that I love to do and be in the classroom. And I still work with those justice impacted youth. So my course is connecting students to those youth and doing summer activities, hiking, swimming, going to the beach. And I just love that. And then during COVID, I realized, like many of us, I realized that I needed something else. I was very interested in doing something different. And this job opened up, being the director of community and civic impact. Community work has always been near and dear to my heart, and I've always been connected to community. So it was a wonderful opportunity for me, and I took it. So I've been in that role for a couple of months. I also am a volunteer. I volunteer quite a lot, not only with in the Latino community, but in other areas as well. So right now I'm a member of the Portland Art Museum Teacher Advisory. I'm also a board member for Portland Audubon, which is a lovely board and an amazing organization. And in the past, I've served in different capacities. I was a commissioner with the Oregon Commission for Hispanic Affairs, which is a governor-appointed position. And while I did that, I was also on the Environmental Justice Task Force. And you know, I've done lots of different things like that. But I think most recently, the thing that I'm most proud of and the thing that I love is that I went back to school about 4 years ago to get a Master's of Fine Arts in Creative Writing Nonfiction. And it was just a late in life realization that I had stories to tell that were important to me. And I felt that there was a, you know, room for them in the community. And so I did that. And a lot has come out of that. I've done a lot of projects and sharing the stories of our community with the larger community. It's been great. I love it.
Wow. Yeah. So many questions for you, I guess, on that. Well, first, are you still teaching?
Yeah, I'm still teaching. I just taught this summer. It was fantastic. Our students actually got to be in the field with the youth, which was really great. I think that the classroom is a very special place. It's a sacred place. And a lot of students that I work with are first generation students, students who identify as Black, Indigenous, Latino, people of color. And so, you know, it's really special to be able to create room at the university for these voices and these experiences that are very unique. And I love it.
So if I interviewed one of your students for the podcast, how would they describe your teaching style?
Oh, my teaching style. Well, I'm very cooperative. I use a lot of popular education methodology. So that is, for those of you who don't know, it is using the knowledge that's already in the room. I believe that each and every one of us have all the knowledge that we need in order to make a healthy, good society. It's just the way that that is brought together in community and with others. And that's where the magic happens. So I would say I'm, you know, collaborative. I really like to bring people along. And more than anything, I just like us to have a good time while we're learning.
That sounds like a great environment to me. We're still learning a lot as a city and as city employees. But like when we're talking about Latino versus Latinx, What should we be using?
That's a question that's very common and an understandable one, especially in our climate today, where we're hyper aware of race and race is up, and we definitely should be paying attention to it. So I appreciate the question. Mm-hmm. I think each community has their way of defining themselves. So the easy answer is, you know, ask the person, ask the group, and use what they use. But I think it's more complicated for us who work in public institutions, in the public sphere, in government. I think it's important to be mindful and be thoughtful and as inclusive as possible. So one thing that you know, that I like to remind people is that, you know, language is evolving, and we have many generations that we're working with all at once. And so thinking about, you know, their experiences are very important. I work with a woman, a very prominent leader in the community, who does not like Latinx. She thinks that it's very alienating, that it doesn't describe her as a person, just really strong feelings about it. And then I work with students who have very strong feelings about using Latinx with an X, because it is more inclusive, gender inclusive, that it includes all people, because our language, the Spanish language, is a gendered language. And so when you say Latino, literally in the language, it means men. You know, you're referring to men who are Latino. I like to use Latine, which is with an E at the end. And I learned this from my oldest kid, who said, you know, I like Latine more, Mom, because I can actually conjugate it. So you can, you know, if you're, you know, somebody who studies the Spanish language, you can't conjugate the X, but you can do an E. And Latine is a word that is more commonly used abroad in Mexico and other parts of Latin America and Spanish-speaking countries. Latine has become a word that has become embraced. And you also hear Latinx, but not so much abroad. You mostly hear that term here. Hispanic, some people might not know that this word was actually a word that was created during the Nixon administration, because there was a census count And they, the Census Bureau actually created that word to help count this community. And
they,
so
they created the word Hispanic.
Hispanic. Yeah. So a lot of people don't know that history, don't know that the U.S. government actually created that word for us. It wasn't something we chose for ourselves, but, you know, depends on where you are. I mean, in rural areas, you know, Hispano, Mexican, Mexican-American, there's a lot of different terms that are used depending on where you are. In Portland, in the urban core, in at Portland State, in the hub of, you know, of Portland State, I think a lot of people embrace Latinx.
That's fascinating about the Hispanic. I did not know that. What was that term supposed to cover?
All people from Spanish-speaking, dominantly Spanish-speaking countries. So it was meant to include, you know, Cubanos, Puerto Ricanos, Mexicans, Colombianos, Guatemaltecos, all of those folks who come from Spanish origin.
We're in the middle of Hispanic Heritage Month, so that term is now, it is acceptable or more mainstream?
Well, I think, you know, Hispanic Heritage Month, like the other heritage months, you know, when you look back and you trace those back to how they were originally, why they were originally created, it was mostly from the public sector. So these are, you know, folks like you and me who really wanted to lift up those communities, saw the importance in that, so created these months as a way to highlight these communities. And so it makes sense then that the word that they used was Hispanic Heritage Month. I've seen people, and I've done this myself, where I'll say Hispanic, but I'll put Hispanic in parentheses, but I'll use Latine or another term, Heritage Month or our Heritage Month, you know, to just bring awareness and attention to that term. But it's very complicated, and I can understand how some people are just like, well, I don't know, just tell me what you use. You know, really, at the end of the day, that's the best question you can ask. What term would you like me to use to describe you? And people ask me, and it really depends on my mood. Some days I'm Mexican American, some days I'm Chicana, which means an enlightened and politically active Mexican American. I don't use the term Hispanic to describe myself or my community. And I worked for an organization for 10 years that used the word Latino. I think what's most important here is not necessarily censoring your language, but knowing why we use the terms we use, that is what matters. Because, you know, it doesn't matter what term you use, if you still don't know why, or if you don't understand the origins, then you're basically just, you know, trying to do something for the good of others. But I encourage people to really educate themselves and think about the terms we use, the words we use, understanding the origin of those terms, because language matters.
I'm sure our listeners just learned something there too. And having that default of simply asking somebody is always the best way, or can be the best way to go. So I want to talk to you about your work in and around city government. When you think about cities in general, how can we do a better job of engaging all of our community?
That's a really good question. At the end of the day, it's intentionality. Bringing on folks like Eduardo, who you mentioned earlier, who works at the city, somebody who understands the community, who represents the community, who is a member of that community, that's where you'll find the most rapid change and the change that really matters and is lasting. When you bring in people from the community who know and who are members of that community you intend to serve, you're going to learn at a much faster rate what it takes and what is important to those communities, what it takes to reach those communities and those things that are important to those communities, which oftentimes are very similar to what everybody else wants. It's just about access. In our communities, we often have fear of government because of the ways that maybe we've either been treated or been left out or been ignored or misunderstood. And so it takes somebody, knowing somebody in the community, to say, no, we really care about you. We care about your voice. We care about your stories. We want to bring you in and we want to learn more. I think that the Latino community is definitely a fast growing community, very similar to the Asian Pacific Islander community. We are growing exponentially. So it's important to pay attention to those population shifts and what they mean. Our population is very young. We also have a lot of homes that are intergenerational. So where you have a very young child, then you have school-age children, and you have elders, and you have, you know, you kind of got everybody in the home. So the ways that those communities and those folks navigate the world and navigate resources that are available to them is going to be a little different, and their needs are going to be different. So having people on your team that know what those stories are and have those direct lived experiences really, really matter, and they really make a big difference. We're also a huge economic engine. We contribute quite a bit economically to the region, the state, and the nation. There's also this misperception that we're a drain on resources. We actually underutilize the resources that are available to us. We tend as a community as a whole to put more into the system than we take out of it. And that's mostly because there are many people who do work and contribute to, for example, taxes, but who may have irregular documentation status. So then in turn, they don't necessarily benefit from the investments they make into the system. So that's another place where, you know, often people have that misperception. So I always like to clear that up. The other thing I like to share, and this is something that I'm learning about more as I focus on environmental justice, climate justice, and because that is an area that's very important to me and a focus of the course that I teach at Portland State, is that, you know, immigrants are very wise. They know how to survive. They have skills. They know what it's like to live in duress. They know what it is to live in a water constrained environment and an energy constrained world. They know what it is to have to work really hard to make ends meet. And so our immigrant communities, our Latino communities, have so much knowledge that cities can learn from, that they can learn how to become climate resilient. What are the things, the ancestral knowledge that immigrants bring around crops, taking care of our earth is so important right now. And I think it's an underutilized area in our community that we haven't done the best that we can to lift up that knowledge. Scientists are important. And of course, you know, everything that we're doing around climate mitigation is so incredibly important, but it's also those individual skills and lifting those up that can really make a big difference in making our communities more resilient to the changes that are coming, that we've already seen, but that are coming.
You know, back to, I think what you said to one of the responses, just being very intentional about our work is so important.
Yeah. And, you know, we're also just talking about affordable housing and childcare. You know, these are the things that make us resilient. When we have affordable housing, safe housing, housing that that is able to protect our families from heat domes, from ice storms, from smoke, you know, that makes all the difference in the world. It really is. I think the environmental front line is housing and also having affordable childcare for our families so that they can get out and do the work that they want to do without fear of their children being in harm's way.
So talk about how this conversation plays out at Portland State in terms of being intentional about reaching all parts of, in this case, like, you know, the campus community, but also the surrounding, the city of Portland really is a big part of it too.
Yeah, you know, we at Portland State, one thing that we're really proud of is our motto, which is let knowledge serve the city. The community is absolutely central to that. And it's one of my personal passions is community. We are nothing without our community. We are the Portland metropolitan area's university. I believe that. And many of our students that come, you know, that come to Portland State are from the area. You know, at Portland State, one thing that I've been doing is lifting up our equity lens. And an equity lens is really important to think about when you're doing this work in government or even just in an organization, even just your business or just being in the world, I think it's important to apply an equity lens to your work, because when we're able to serve those that are in the margins, those that are, you know, institutionally held back or have a lack of power just because of their identity or who they are, or the color of their skin, when we're able to reach those communities and those communities then in turn are able to reach their full human potential, everybody benefits. So when we talk about an equity lens, there's some things that come to mind. For example, is equity given the same emphasis as other priorities? So as you know, as folks are identifying their priorities, their strategic priorities, whatever it is that they're hoping to accomplish, are they thinking about equity in the same way that they're thinking about other things that they want to accomplish? If we're committed, like for example, you know, if Tigard is committed to equity, then we need to make sure that whatever efforts are there reflect the interests of those most affected by those decisions. So making sure that those decisions have people at the table to help shape what those are that are the people that will be impacted. And, you know, are we making decisions on behalf of these groups? Are we including them? You know, those communities and their advocates wherever practical, it's very important. And as we so, create, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt you on that. And this is real life. This is the equity lens discussion is one that we're struggling with and trying to work through. So if we take something like parks, and I don't know, we can pick an example of building a park, remodeling a park, whatever you think is easiest, how do you apply an equity lens?
One good question to ask is, like, who's affected, right? So if you're going to build a park or expand a park, like who's affected by that decision? Positively, negatively, not at all? Whatever it is that you're drafting up in your plan, and asking those questions intentionally, going out, doing focus groups, going to community organizations where those communities already convene instead of asking them to come to you, incentivizing those interactions to make sure that the community knows. And when I say incentivizing, like I'm saying, like, you know, buy food for the community, you know, partner, you know, where these gatherings are maybe already happening, or it may be a faith-based organization, a church or something like that. You know, make it fun, you know, maybe have like music at the event, or, you know, a clown to make, animal balloons for the children, whatever it is, it's going to animate those folks to really believe in whatever it is that you want to do. And then ask them, like, hey, what do you think about this park? We want to build a park down the street from your house, or, you know, or we know that, you know, this part of, like, one area that I work in a lot is Outer East Portland in the Rockwood community. It's a large population of Latine people out there, high concentrations of poverty. It's a food desert out there. There's not many grocery stores. There are, you know, very few public services and parks. So when you're asking these groups, you know, you want to find out, you know, what is it that's important to them? One thing that they've identified out there is a community center. So Latino Network right now is in the middle of a capital campaign to build a community center out in the heart of Rockwood, where we know that community have said over and over again, we don't have services, we don't have a safe place for our children to go and play or do activities. And so this community center is a real beacon of hope for that community, because it's really been inclusive from the beginning. It's included those voices, and those voices have really been central to those plans. I think at the end of the day, we want to think about how any effort or any initiative supports the rights of all people to live in a healthy environment. Because without a healthy environment, what do you have? You don't have anything. You have, you know, a dysfunctional city, really. So this is about creating a healthy environment. And when you create a healthy environment for one community, even if you focus on one community, you're going to be doing it for everybody. That's the benefit. That's the beauty of this work.
Well, so on the equity lens, maybe I'm trying to squish two things together here. How do you account for, if we're talking about a park expansion or building a park, how do you account for, or do you account for, the history of the community? I mean, I think we all know that the Latino community, African-American community, others have not had an equal footing in the past with most in most communities. Do you account for that in the equity lens, or is that a separate discussion?
I think that you definitely pulled that in. I think history is very important. One place to think about that are unincorporated parts of a city, or parts of the city that were recently incorporated, and what was it like before they were incorporated, and what are the benefits that are afforded to those communities, you know, before incorporation, you know, and then after, and how then, like sidewalks, really simple things like sidewalks or other amenities can have such a profound impact. And then there's also dangers, right? So we saw gentrification happen along Williams in Portland, along Alberta and other areas of the city, where we saw major push out. You know, you bring in crosswalks, you bring in, you know, affordable housing, you bring in these things that you think are really going to benefit a community, economic development. And then all of a sudden you realize that really what it did was create room for folks from the dominant community to come in and benefit from those policies and initiatives that are originally intended to benefit those most marginalized in that community. So, you know, you got to be mindful, you got to be careful. And I think, again, it's about having those communities at the table every step of the way. And more importantly, not just having them there like as a token, right? But yep. Really is having them there as equal partners and listening to their stories, incorporating their stories, and understanding that we speak a different language in the public sector. We have all these fancy words that can be very alienating, and they don't make sense to a lot of people, you know.
A lot of acronyms,
you know, and then this sentiment of, well, you're this overeducated person that's really not here to serve me. You're just here to serve yourself and those that, you know, those powers that be, you know. And what we really want to do here is we want to be intentional every step of the way, including people, bringing them in. The work that Eduardo is doing and bringing in Spanish speakers, monolingual Spanish speakers, is so important because their voice matters just as much as anybody else's voice. Knowing another language is not, it's a sign of intelligence. And those folks that are living in our communities, just think how resilient they are. Just think what their brain has to do in order to live and survive in an environment where they don't know the language. These folks have tremendous skills and assets that that could benefit everybody. And so it's about making sure that those communities are heard and that what they say is being implemented.
Yeah, I, you know, something you said really hit home. I think where government does its biggest disservice is we start a conversation and the conversation is asking you for something and you may or may not respond, and then that's it. And we're not intentional about building a relationship, partially because that takes time, effort, takes money. But if I come up to somebody on the street and ask them to fill out a survey and they don't know me, that's not the way to build a relationship or to build any sort of trust. And we're often too quick to skip those steps because we have a project need in mind, with disregard to the overall goal of building these relationships and eventually being able to have meaningful conversations about these projects without just, you know, shoving another survey into somebody's face or inbox.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the sense of urgency that we have is real, and there is urgency, and especially around climate justice. That is absolutely an urgent issue. And we're addressing that at Portland State for sure. But I think the sense of urgency it encourages us to skip over that very important step, and that's the relational piece. And that's why I love my job so much, because that's what it's about. It's about building relationships.
That's great. In preparing for this interview, in doing a Google search, as I always do for our upcoming guests, and in this case, talking to Eduardo, but I read an article about your efforts to rename 39th Avenue to Cesar Chavez Boulevard in Portland. The first half of the article was all about your effort, not only you, but the group's efforts and how great things were going. And then the second part really dove into those roadblocks that you encountered along the way of seemingly something that shouldn't be too contentious. Thinking back to that, what did you learn? What did you take away from that and experience?
As part of my research, I dove into the city archives and also community leaders who had, you know, documented their experience, the paperwork and everything, and working with the city of Portland to rename a major thoroughfare in Portland after Cesar Chavez Boulevard. It started with Interstate. That failed because of the, really, at the end of the day, it was because members of the community were so vehemently against it that that members of city council really were concerned that it was going to become an immigration debate and not a, a debate about whether we should name the street or not. There were a
on what grounds? I mean, Interstate Avenue seems pretty innocuous.
Well, I think people had experienced two renamings in their communities, the Interstate, which is the Overlook neighborhood. Rosa Parks Boulevard was renamed, and so was Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. And I think that they felt that those two renamings caught them off guard, that they weren't included in the conversation when those renamings happened. And it is true, when MLK was renamed, there was no city code to guide the process. And it was a contentious, very contentious renaming when you look at that history. Rosa Parks Boulevard is another one where a city commissioner just decided we're going to do this, and they did, and they didn't really tell anybody. They just kind of they had created the code, but then they didn't adhere to the code when they renamed that street. So and Natal Parkway is another one that was renamed, also did not adhere to the code. Natal Park, the code clearly states that whatever, whoever you rename the street after, that person must have been deceased for 5 years. Mr. Nato had only been deceased not even a year when they renamed Front Avenue in downtown after Nato. So by the time the Cesar Chavez Boulevard Committee came forth with this idea to rename Interstate, you know, because it's a low, because it's a very mixed income neighborhood, because there were a lot of Latinos in the area, they thought, the committee thought it was like a perfect, you know, street to rename Interstate. They didn't think it was going to have historical significance, which is something that they have to do. They have to research the historical significance of the name that they're trying to replace. All of those things seemed in line. But then at the end of the day, it was because the government or the people in that community didn't have faith or trust in each other and in the government. And the system is set up in such a way that it really pits us against each other. And in this case, the code really worked against the committee. By the time the committee decided they wanted to rename 39th Avenue, which is which, you know, cuts through East Portland and into parts of it's all along the east side, north and south. You know, people were really worked up about it. I think that at the end of the day, there was a lot of misunderstanding. I think that people didn't understand the community. The Latino community is often segregated from the rest of the communities. And so there wasn't a mutual understanding of what these communities had to offer, what the benefit would be. But at the end of the day, the committee was successful, but it was very contentious, and it was a very traumatic experience for our community, because I think that it allowed people to say things that maybe they felt that they couldn't say in other areas or for other initiatives because it was Cesar Chavez. And so it was a very painful time in our history. That happened over 11 years ago. But the article, you know, still rings true today in the way that there's a lot of just misunderstandings about who we are.
If you were to embark on that same process today, would it be different?
Interestingly, there are some efforts that are coming. One is to rename Jackson Avenue, which is in downtown Portland, and it sits in front of our Native American Student and Community Center. And President Jackson doesn't have the best reputation, let's just put it that way, in the indigenous community. And so there's an effort to rename that street. So it'll be really interesting to see how that process plays out. It's something the community wants. And so it'll be really interesting. I'm not quite sure. I feel like at this point, you know, because that street is such a little short, it's a short street. It's not very long. And because of its location in downtown Portland at Portland State, I don't think that it will have the same scrutiny as a street like 39th Avenue or Interstate. And they had talked about, the Cesar Chavez Boulevard Committee had talked about, they proposed Broadway as a street to rename. So they're, you know, I think that this is a little different. So it'd be interesting. It'll be interesting in the future to see if we were to, you know, rename another street after a prominent civil rights activist or a prominent leader, particularly like a woman or a person of color, what would happen. I think we have a different understanding because of everything that's happened since George Floyd. I think people have an increased awareness. And that benefits us because it opens the door for us to have more conversations.
That's interesting that you mentioned that. And, you know, as a 43-year-old white male, it's easy for me to say, why does this matter? Renaming one street, is it possible? I mean, how to describe or give insight into the importance of these type of decisions, whether it's renaming a street or taking down a monument? Can you talk about the importance that is for communities, whether it's Latino community or African American community?
Absolutely. Yes. I think it's very, you know, monuments, street names, building names, these things matter. And when you have, for example, we are on indigenous land. We're on the land of the Multnomah, the Clathlamet, the Tumwater, the Tualatin Kalapuya people. These people have been here, you know, for decades, for as long as one can remember, right? And history knows that that's true. And we've done the research. We know that indigenous people were here, and we are here because of them. We owe our allegiance to those people, and we owe them not only land and their ability to be sovereign nations, but also their understanding. And that all of that is so important because it really speaks volumes to how we value people. I mean, why do we rename a building after a person? Because we value that person and what they represent and what they've done for their community. So if you look around at all the street names, at the building names, there are very, very, very few that are named after people of color, local activists, activists like Cesar Chavez, who was a farm worker rights advocate. Very few are. So when we do then have a renaming, something as significant as Cesar Chavez, it sends a message to the broader community, as well as our own community, that those communities matter and that we care about them enough to rename a street after them. And then what results from there is then people are curious, well, who is Cesar Chavez? Why, you know, why do we have a street named after him? And then maybe they'll go and do a search online and learn more. Maybe there'll be curriculum in school about those things because all of a sudden those things matter in a way that they didn't before.
Yeah, that's really well said. And so my story is I moved to the West Coast about 15 years ago. My wife and I lived in Richmond, Virginia, which was the capital of the Confederacy. So monuments are certainly nothing new to me. But when I moved out here, I felt a strong impression from folks in this area that, and stereotypes about, you know, South is where the racism is and South is where, you know, they put other people down. But the sad fact is that the longer I'm here, I learn about the history of Portland, whether that's Vanport, Indian land that you just mentioned, and then some of the things we did to those communities. And it's really a great reminder to keep our eyes open and learn our history on where we're at. The sad fact is we're all guilty, whether you live in the South or Northwest. There's things that happen that aren't something that we should be proud of. And so finding ways to address that, I think, are so important. And so that's been eye-opening for me. And so to hear some of the history about the streets that you talk about and some of the monuments around here, it's been fascinating to watch and see some of the reactions. Some of those reactions aren't that different than what I see in the South when you see monuments coming down. And
yeah, I mean, I think people have this perception that, you know, Portland is this activist place and that we're all very, you know, liberal over here. And the truth is that The oppression that we see in society, the racism, the sexism, the, you know, all the things that hold people down just because of their identity, not because of anything they've done, right? But just because of the color of their skin, their gender, their sexual orientation, whatever it is, fill in the blank. Maybe it's their economic status. If they're poor, maybe if they don't have shelter or something like that. You know, all of those things in society, we all have preconceived notions about those groups. And so I think that every single one of us in society have a lot of work ahead of us in unpacking that and understanding why it is that our society is set up that way. And Portland is not immune, certainly not immune. And one thing that we have in Portland that is really interesting is this thing called Portland Nice. You know, we tend to be really nice to each other, very polite. Yeah. You know, we're very conflict avoidant. So then when we do see conflict, it's like, whoa, what's going on? Like, people just don't know how to handle it. Understandable. It's a cultural thing. But I think it's important for all of us to understand that there are people that have been living in duress and in crisis and have been traumatized just because of the color of their skin or just who they are, especially in Portland, that is a very white city. It is, but also it is very diverse. You know, people say Portland is so white. Yeah, well, not my Portland. I mean, almost everybody I hang out with are people of color. They're Latino. They speak multiple languages. And yes, it's the nature of my work, but it's also a choice that I've made in my life to incorporate myself and integrate myself into those communities, and not just the Latino community, but all communities and communities of color, the Slavic community, the Middle Eastern North African South Asian community, the African-American Black community, the Indigenous community, all those communities, they have a lot to teach us and how we can be a better community.
Well, and our demographic is changing, whether people like that or not, and it is becoming more diverse. So,
yeah. And we need to open doors to dialogue, because what we find is that when we're in groups that are mixed, you know, we have people from all different backgrounds and they all come together and they sit in the same room. I was part of this movement called the Sanctuary Movement. This was years and years ago, not Sanctuary like we know it today, but it was a faith-based organization who would bring together people from different racial groups and would put them in a room and have dialogue and hear each other's stories. And it was a beautiful, beautiful movement, because it really encouraged people to listen to each other. And what almost universally everybody said is, you know, we have a lot more in common than we have differences. And so it's important to focus on those times when we can come together as a community and really learn and listen from each other.
Yeah, that storytelling aspect kind of harkens back with at the beginning of this conversation of you going back to school and focus on storytelling. It is so important to learn people's stories, and that can be oversimplified, but its importance can't be underestimated. Mm-hmm. With that said, I've taken up a lot of your time. I have two final ones for you. You can take it in any direction you want. The first one, are you hopeful for the future?
I am. I'm so hopeful, especially when I see young people and the ideas that they have and their enthusiasm to make change. Just last week, I think it was, the climate strike happened. Many students from throughout the nation walked out of their classrooms to demand climate action. It's those things that give me hope.
Yeah, I haven't met you in person, but you seem like a hopeful person. So that was kind of the answer I was expecting. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy that you are. That should give all of us some hope. Last question that I'll let you go on. We ask this to all of our guests. So, Cynthia, if you could pick any song to end this podcast with, what song would you pick?
Wow, a song, huh?
This is always the question that tricks people up. I could ask them anything else, but like this question is always draw. Your reaction is very similar to the 50-some other guests that we've talked to.
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. A lot of the music that I listen to is Spanish language, you know, Spanish language music. But there's this beautiful song. I'm forgetting the name of it right now, but I think it's called Mi Querido México. It's by a band or by a woman. Her name is Natalia Lafourcade. She's a tremendous, incredible Mexican artist. And she wrote a song about just Mexico and There's another song by a band called La Santa Cecilia, and it's called Mexico Americano. And it's this really beautiful, uplifting song about, you know, about somebody who was born in the United States but has heritage, a Mexican heritage, and their pride. You know, something that I think is really unique about our communities is we're very, very patriotic. We are very, very, you know, we just, we, in Mexico, we love elections and we just get really into it, you know. And here in the United States, I think that's been silenced, and it's really a shame because we really love that stuff, you know. We love to like root for our candidate and all of that, you know. And I'm really excited for a time here, hopefully soon, where we start seeing the beautiful love that Latinos have of this country. They love this country. We, you know, we just love living here in the United States. There's a reason why we sacrificed everything and left our families to come here. And not all of us crossed the border, you know. For many of us, the border crossed us. So then there's that, right? It's very complicated. So it wasn't too long ago in 1848 that Oregon actually bordered Mexico. Our southern border was the Oregon-California border was Mexico. And when the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo was signed in 1848, you know, all that land was lost by the Mexican government, and then created the current border that we have today. So there are so many people that have been here for generations that just have so much love for our country. And so I'm really excited to see that more and more as people come to understand what that is and make room for it.
Well, I love the passion with what you speak with, and I'm gonna add your songs to our Talking Tiger playlist. So hopefully that will expand people's musical horizons. And I do want to thank you for your time today. I know we're all busy these days, but it's been really fun talking to you.
It's been an honor and a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you, Eduardo, for thinking of me.
Yeah, shout out to Eduardo, and shout out. If our listeners don't know, we do have a Spanish podcast called In Contacto, which publishes about once a month. So I encourage you to check that out. Leave a 5-star iTunes review. And you can send guest ideas for future episodes of Talking Tiger or In Contacto to email those to me at kentw@tiger-or.gov. I also encourage you to stay connected with the City of Tiger on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Cynthia, thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yep, you have a good one.